Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift were two of the biggest film stars of the 1950s. Together, they brought masculine intensity and vulnerability to the big screen in ways that audiences had not seen before. A new play opening next week will explore these two lives. The play is simply called Idol. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. The upcoming stage production of Joel Murray's play Idol looks at the complicated relationship between Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift and explores what made the two cinema icons tick. The play is a production of the Border Theater and is directed by Austin Savage, who also plays Montgomery Clift. And I'm happy to have Austin Savage back in the studio today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to see you.
You as well.
Wearing multiple roles in this. And I know the Border Theater is one of your labors of love. This is obviously a film show, but this is one of those interesting crossover connections between stage and screen that often happens in film history.
Yeah, it's super fascinating because even the production itself, we're tinkering around with the two different mediums. You know, you kind of have to. And we're playing around with the idea, obviously, you know, even from the very title of the piece, The Idol, these versions, these presented public versions of themselves, these iconic film, you know, images that they put forward, and then, of course, the people behind it.
And the craft.
Right. Yeah, the craft is the thing for them, too, was they were obsessed with it. And it's one of those things that leads to constant source of argument for me, whether it's in, you know, coffee shops or bars or something along those lines, is this oft repeated and just, you know, the Brando persona. People really, really gravitate towards that. He didn't learn his lines or, you know.
Mumbled his way through things.
Yeah, he just clutched shirts and, you know, and smashed. And, you know, it's really fascinating to me because there's this assumption that, and I've run into this quite a bit, especially with performers, who almost take that as like an opportunity to denigrate the craft out of like laziness or something.
Well, I'll just
Brando my way through it. Not understanding, one, he was, in fact, a very innate genius. And two, that may have been the persona he created. But there's no doubt that he had efforted and worked and you know.
Right.
In a lot of ways, I truly believe that he presented himself as the idiot savant because he found that way more palatable than someone.
So you're saying that maybe that transparency he had of not having worked hard at what he was doing was actually really hard to pull off.
Yeah, exactly. You know, especially when you see a lot of his kind of public persona quotes where he talks about how being an actor is really unimportant and that you should do important things with his life. And we saw aspects of that with this social activism.
Right.
And he really admired people who were skilled in ways he wasn't, which was the case pretty much for everybody.
And Montgomery Clift, a very different persona.
Yeah, and that's one of the fascinating things that that's one of the fascinating things that they talk about is that Monty was absolutely the opposite. He was completely and utterly obsessed. Everything you read about him and all his friends and rivals and people on set talked about just the absolute obsession that he had. And that bled over to everybody. Young Elizabeth Taylor and Frank Sinatra and even Burt Lancaster talked about it, you know. And I think that's part of, it's one of the interesting things that they explore in the play. It's a source of conflict. And it's interesting because they were, in a certain extent, kind of rivals and as contemporaries. And I know for a fact, you can read it, that it just absolutely agitated him that he had to work so hard. And he believed that there's this guy out there who would just stumble into something.
Right.
And it was just this constant source of frustration, you know?
Consummate craftspeople, both coming up at a time in the late 40s where they were part of this new movement, early members of the Actors Studio, which would become an iconic breeding ground for many of our greatest actors that flourished in the 50s, but very different persona and temperaments where they weren't always competing for similar roles because they were physically different, they came across differently on screen, but they both hit about the same time in the early 50s.
Right, yeah, and it's interesting that you brought that up. The Actors Studio both had their thoughts on that experience too, but I mean, the background couldn't have been any more different. You know, Marlon, interestingly enough, I always thought this was super fascinating. They were both born in Omaha, Nebraska.
Which
how fascinating.
Which just seems really, really bizarre. And it's almost like, other than their place of birth, the rest of their life was different. You know, Monty's mother was Confederate descended Gentile South kind of aristocracy, and his father was a kind of, you know, a Wall Street type banker. So he spent his youth, you know, traveling Europe, and then became a child star and was kind of molded on Broadway up until he was 30. And then he came and, you know, immediately broke the studio system, which made him a pariah in a lot of ways to a lot of the existing stars. And then Marlon, on the other hand, was a military school kid who got kicked out, and he was, you know, a
rebel.
Well, they both had broken homes in their own kind of way. But he kind of just, with no place left to go, no recourse, joined his sister in New York. She was at Stella Adler. He was crashing on her couch. She took him one day, and he was off and running within a matter of a couple of years.
Yeah, and through that experience, they both hit it big in 51. Marlon Brando, of course, with A Streetcar Named Desire, the film, which he had already played in the stage production. And with Montgomery Clift, while he had done some film work, particularly in Red River in the late 40s, A Place in the Sun, I think, was the one that just kind of 1951 launched his A-list career.
Absolutely. Red River and The Search was actually one that got him his first, you know, performance nomination.
So where does the play take all of this? You've got these two giant icons of the screen and, as you say, craftsmen of the acting. What period do we find them in, and how do these two come together in the play?
Yeah, interestingly enough, I do know that the genesis of this play actually came from a Marlon Brando television interview where he talked about a visit he paid to Monty post Raintree County. So this occurs after Raintree County, which, you know, for the listeners, it was a big blockbuster film, you know, where he was pairing with Elizabeth Taylor once more. Monty and Elizabeth were the kind of icons of their era, the duo of their era. And it was supposed to be this kind of Gone with the Wind style, large-scale epic. And mid-production, unfortunately, Monty got into a car crash right outside Elizabeth Taylor's home and disfigured his face pretty horrifically. And he finished the film, and there was an obvious change in physical appearance. So this kind of eternally youthful Bobby Sox dreamboat, you know, poster icon type thing was gone. And that was really just kind of the culmination of a cycle of addiction and health problems and a lot of psychological issues stemming from his sexuality that it forced him into a period of seclusion.
So the play imagines an evening in the life where Marlon Brando pops in and checks on
his old friend competitor, this man who was in genuine hiding, kind of ashamed of, he used the excuse of his disfigured face, but you know, I mean, it could be argued that this was a long time coming for him. Anyway,
he always had a certain, to me at least on screen, a certain introversion.
Yeah.
You know, he could withdraw into this place.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and you mentioned it perfectly, you know, machismo and vulnerability and, you know, his insecurity was massive just about every level, professionally and personally. You know, it's hard to, when you read about him, there was, you know, he was this vibrant young man and then something kind of happened to him.
You're directing the play, but you're also playing Montgomery Clift in the play. And we should mention it's Frank Layall is playing Marlon Brando.
Right, right.
So when you're out casting or blocking or directing with a play with two giant actors that are being portrayed on stage as well, I mean, are you looking to find the tics and things that people will recognize as, oh, that's Marlon, that's how Marlon Brando, the movements and such, the physical appearance, or is it something else you're looking for as a director?
No, that's a really good question. This is something that we talked about right off the beginning, even in the casting process. I mentioned it to anyone interested, is especially in the case of Frank, who I think has a slightly more difficult job than I do, just because Marlon is more iconic contemporary than Monty is. You know, you have to give us something so that the audience doesn't shut down.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not necessarily a piece about impersonation.
Right.
You know.
You don't want a caricature.
Right, right. And, you know, obviously when you watch amazing performances like Ray and Walk the Line, the impersonatory factor is what wins a lot of people over. So they end up with Academy
Awards.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But I am far less interested in that as opposed to just kind of the living interaction on stage. Mm-hmm. But there definitely is an aspect where we've been watching and researching. Luckily, we have a member of our production team who's got a master's degree in linguistics and that kind of stuff. So she knows enough, and we've taken enough vocal training to where we're kind of tinkering around with, but in all honesty, these two really, really strange and unique vocal patterns. He's working on his Marlin and he's making progress on that. But obviously it's almost like at this point, people are more famous with the parody of his voice than the actual voice.
Or late Marlin.
Right.
Where he was late, almost a parody of himself.
Which is, again, kind of interesting.
Fascinating.
That's something that they explore. You know, Monty says to him quite a bit. And this is apparently something he said in real life. If you don't look out, you'll become a parody of yourself.
Interesting. Were there certain films that you were drawn to try to figure out, you know, just how to make these guys tick on stage, or certain moments, and moving image moments that you think of when you think of these two characters?
We talked about it, despite all its controversy. And it is a little later in his life, but Last Tango in Paris is apparently about as naked as... And that's the whole thing. These guys were...
Literally.
Yeah. The whole thing about these two guys, they were, you know, supposedly very naked on screen. So you could watch just about any of their performances and get a clue. But Last Tango, those tales he reveals are very... Those are his mannerisms. As far as me with Monty, the brief appearance in Judgment at Nuremberg, I thought was powerful. And more so than anything, the opening... His first appearance in The Misfits, when he's on the phone booth talking to his mother. Apparently Arthur Miller wrote that in because he knew about his kind of maternal issues, and he apparently has a brutal thing to watch being filmed, so just makes sense that would be something.
So this is going to be at Glassbox. If people have not been to Glassbox, let us know where that is.
Sure, yeah. Glassbox is 210 Poplar. It's right off of Piedras. All right, where Piedras and Texas Avenue meet. Just below I-10, by 5 points.
Coming up two weekend runs, April 14th to 16th and 21st to 23rd. Tickets are?
Tickets are $7 for students, and that's high school, college, whatever, any student, and then $10 general admission.
Fantastic. Well, I will certainly be there because this sounds fascinating. So thank you, Austin, for coming in.
All right, thank you.
I've been discussing the upcoming Border Stage production of Idle with director and actor Austin Savage. Idle was written by playwright Joel Murray and explores the relationship of two of the cinema's biggest stars, Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift. The production will run April 14th to the 16th and April 21st to the 23rd at Glassbox, and tickets are just $7 and $10. You can find more information and buy tickets at bordertheater.org, and that's theater spelled with an R-E. Thanks to Kimberly Garcia today for engineering the show. An archive of past programs is available on this station's website at ktep.org. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.